and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Tuesday, December 22nd. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. On the front page, more than statistics. Families of COVID-19 victims share stories of loved ones' lives and deaths. This is reported by Bennett Goldstein from Piasta. Sue White held her husband's hand as he took his last breaths. She prepared herself for the third service she would attend within 8 weeks to mark the death of a family member. First her brother, then her mother-in-law, now her high school sweetheart with whom she embarked on a 49-year marriage. "I'm ready for this year to be over," Sue said, "and hopefully next year will be better." Rick White, 69, of Piasta, died in October after contracting the novel coronavirus, which causes the disease COVID-19. Sue, a retired secretary and receptionist, included the cause of death in Rick's obituary. She wanted to illustrate the disease's pernicious effects. "Some people don't realize how bad it is until they start losing somebody close to them," said Sue, 71. Since January, the coronavirus has infected more than 10,200 people in Dubuque County and been linked to more than 140 deaths. "Now, Rick is a statistic," Sue said. "It's not a good feeling." Sue met Rick in 1967 at Eagle Point Funland in Dubuque. At the park, he staffed the roller coaster rink and she the concession stand and go-kart track. Rick was not intimidated that Sue was 2 years his senior. "He told me at one time that all the other girls his age were immature," Sue said. Neither possessed a driver's license, so Rick's father drove them to the movie theater on their first date. After 4 years, they married. They shared a love for travel. Sue clutched Rick atop the Honda Goldwing motorcycle as he steered them between the bluffs and farmlands surrounding Dubuque. They sailed on cruises. After retiring in 2007 from a decades-long career in information technology management, Rick began driving first a school bus and then a motor coach. He ferried diners and theatergoers to Chicago and pro-life advocates to the annual March for Life in Washington, D.C. Every other year, Rick bussed a club of Northeast Iowa rabbit breeders to expos where they would show and sell the critters. He operated the bus lift as the riders loaded cages. More rabbits filled the vehicle than humans. Trips halted in March when the spread of the coronavirus prompted the shutdown of some businesses. Sue's brother, Tom Kaysbauer, and mother-in-law, Eileen White, took pains to avoid exposure to the virus. Tom, 63, worked as a semi-trailer tractor mechanic for more than 25 years and loved the Chicago Bears, NASCAR, and his cats, Honeybee and Chucky. He died in August after a prolonged hospitalization. Eileen, 92, passed away 3 days later. Before she contracted the virus, Eileen began her days at the kitchen table with a newspaper and coffee. She could look out at the woods that border her rural East Dubuque, Illinois home and spot deer and wild turkey. She declined intubation at the hospital, telling the staff she was ready to go, a shock to her family. Nurses removed the nose piece that delivered extra oxygen to Eileen. As she lay in bed, she reminisced with Rick, his brother, and Sue before closing her eyes. Michael Bulow of Dubuque always carried a toothpick on his person ever since he quit smoking. Sometimes he fell asleep with one in his mouth, and his family would be unsurprised to learn that over the years he probably ate a number of them. After Michael died in November from COVID-19, his wife of 58 years, Cheryl Bulow, and their daughters Amy Osten, 58, and Jenny Jensen, 51, unpacked her belongings as she settled into a new apartment. Cheryl, 71, left Eagle Point Place, the nursing home into which she and Michael had moved in January. Physicians diagnosed Michael, 79, with dementia in 2015, and the nursing home offered him ample opportunities to socialize. He joined residents in weekly bingo games and chair fitness classes. He visited the home's chapel, where he prayed the rosary. He absolutely loved it there, Cheryl said. But after he and Cheryl contracted the virus, the nursing home was filled with too many painful memories. Michael tested positive for the coronavirus in late October, but even under Cheryl's tender care, he stopped eating. By the week's end, Michael gasped for breath, and paramedics rushed him to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. For more than 30 years, Michael had worked as a developmental engineer for John Deere Dubuque Works, and later ran an environmental consulting business. He never understood he had dementia. As the condition progressed, Michael struggled to articulate his wants. When he was confined to the hospital with COVID-19, he made himself understood. "Take me home, please," he told his family. "Shoes." Leaving him was excruciating, Amy said. Doctors determined Michael had a low chance of recovery and said he was not a good candidate for intubation. During their final visit, Michael appeared to sleep, but as the family sang Amazing Grace, he started to mouth the words. On her cell phone, Amy played his favorite prayer, Ave Maria. Michael used to sing the hymn in church. He slowly lifted his hands as though he was conducting a choir. 4 days later, Cheryl continued unpacking her apartment. Jenny lifted a small wooden box. Underneath was a toothpick. "He should not have died," Cheryl said. Dolly Aldonate treasured her family, but like any concerned matriarch, she held them to great expectations. She was always speaking highly of her kids to her family and friends. "There was always my Charlie, my Anna, my Michael," said Dolly's daughter, Anna and Aldonate, 34. "She just knew that we could become good people and do something." At 5'2" tall, Dolly might have been slight of stature, but she spent her life pursuing expansive goals. Born in 1955 in Cochabamba, Bolivia, Dolly moved to Mexico, where she studied accounting at University of Monterey. She immigrated to the U.S. in the mid-70s. Dolly, 65, taught Spanish and math in Chicago before moving to St. Donatus, Iowa, where her mother and stepfather lived on a farm. A single mother, Dolly raised Anna and her two sons, Charles and Michael Lipstock, in Bellevue. She worked at Silver Eagle Casino in East Dubuque, Illinois, and Diamond Joe Casino in Dubuque, before starting an auto body repair shop and tow company, which she ran for about 30 years. Her energy seemed limitless, fueled by a love of black coffee. When Dolly was not volunteering at St. Patrick Catholic School, she attended the orchestra and ballet performances and sports games of her 10 grandchildren, treating them afterward to dinner or dessert. Dolly insisted they learn Spanish and maintain a connection to their Bolivian heritage. "If you started out the conversation in Spanish, you better have finished it in Spanish," Anna said. "It was not just hola, ¿cómo estás?" Dolly retired in 2015 and moved to Dubuque. In July, she underwent surgery at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. A nurse called Anna to inform her that Dolly had tested positive for the coronavirus and was being moved to the intensive care unit. Dolly's brother, David Aldonate, Anna and Michael visited 3 days later. Masked, gowned, and gloved, Anna noticed the peculiar absence of sensation as she squeezed her mother's hands in her own. As they cried, they teased Dolly in jest. "It looks like you haven't combed your hair in a few days," they joked. Dolly rolled her eyes and asked for a comb. Charlie joined them through a video call, and Dolly called her grandchildren on the phone. She asked them to care for each other. Before Anna left the ICU, she had a moment alone with her mother. "I told her it was okay if she couldn't fight anymore, that we would all be okay," Anna said, "and I think that is all she needed to hear." Dolly died the next morning. Each winter, Dolly's family looked forward to her creamy rice pudding and caramel-covered flan. Anna made her best attempt this year in her mother's stead. "It made the house smell really good," she said. It reminded Anna of her mom. The coughing started in mid-September. Both Sue and Rick White tested positive for coronavirus, and while she recovered within a few days, Rick's list of ailments grew. His breath was labored. He stopped eating and slept most hours. Sue convinced Rick to drop by an acute care clinic. Staff relayed him to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center, where doctors admitted him to the ICU. "It never entered my mind that he wouldn't come home," Sue said. Rick seemed to improve, but by October he required breathing assistance. Doctors recommended that a mask be placed over Rick's face to deliver pressurized air to his lungs. His health seemed to improve, but suddenly changed course. Hospital staff set Rick's oxygen flow to the maximum level. From the ICU, he began planning for his death. He told Sue to talk to their financial advisor. He asked his son to take care of Sue. 5 days later, they hurried to Rick's bedside a second time. He could not speak with his mask on and could not remove it long enough to talk. He handed Sue his phone, on which he had typed a message. Quote, "Life is a unique journey whose path no one can predict," it read. Ongoing quote, "This journey begins at birth and ends unavoidably with death. My journey is coming to an end, and to my family, friends, and acquaintances, thank you for the memories. I am blessed." Unquote. Rick feared intubation. He did not want to suffer. He wanted to die on his own terms. Sue understood. At 3 a.m., a nurse took off Rick's mask. Sue held his hand. The article is accompanied by several pictures, the largest being that of Rick White, 69, shown with his wife Sue and their family in a picture taken around 2014. Rick White died of COVID-19 in October. The second picture is of Michael Bulow, 79, of Dubuque, shown with his wife Cheryl, as a picture was taken around 2016, and Michael died of COVID-19 in November. And the final picture is of Dolly Aldunate and with her children and grandchildren in a 2018 picture. And as in the article mentioned, Dolly had died of COVID-19 in July. The article is also accompanied by pictures of several of the people who are also mentioned in the article. Thomas Kaysbauer and Eileen White. A second article on the front page, Farley Manufacturer Plans Major Expansion. Benke Enterprises will add to its current facility, build another. Reported by Annie Meal, and of course it's from Farley. Only 2 years after completing a major expansion, a Farley manufacturer will construct two more additions as it continues to bolster its product line and advance its operation. Benke Enterprises will add 96,000 square feet to its current facility, as well as build a 9,600 square foot facility. The company manufactures a variety of trailers for customers in the agricultural, construction, heavy haul, and commercial industries. "It's been a very busy year," said Chad Benke, an officer with Benke Enterprises, whose parents, Margie and Jerry Benke, run the company. "Demand has been very high. We have diversified our product line and came out with some new models and entered new markets. It's just a result of that demand that's driving it." The company started in Holy Cross in 1987 and moved to Farley 11 years later. Its initial operation was 24,000 square feet, but it had grown to 128,000 square feet by 2012. In 2018, the company added 62,000 square feet to the site as trailer sales across the nation continued to boom. In September 2018, trailer orders in the U.S. reached a record high at 58,228, according to America's Commercial Transport Research Company. Then, this year, U.S. trailer orders reached 54,200 this October, which is the third best monthly tally in industry history. During the same time last year, there were 31,786 orders. Now, after years of continued growth, Benke Enterprises is hoping to wrap up its latest expansion in the spring of 2021, he said. Benke said the larger addition will be used for assembly work and will be where most of the welding work occurs. It will allow the company to grow its equipment fleet and invest in a new state-of-the-art painting system. George Davis, president of Farley Development Corporation, said other than the development of Western Dubuque biodiesel, this is the largest industrial expansion in Farley's history. It's just very exciting to be in a community like Farley where we have so many thriving businesses, he said. They are a national leader in trailer manufacturing now. It's just really exciting to see local people do well. Although the COVID-19 pandemic has been a challenge for the company, like so many others, Benke said the groundwork for the latest expansion had been laid through years of hard work. Those efforts included just building up our dealer network and expanding to different parts of the country, and now we are seeing the real returns on it this year, he said. The company recently added a few employees, bringing its workforce to 125, and will continue to hire more workers over the course of the next year, Benke said. We're just trying to stay on top of all the technological equipment that's coming out on the market, and investment in that has really helped us gain this growth, he said. Dan McDonald, Vice President of Existing Businesses for Greater Dubuque Development Corporation, said Benke Enterprises is a poster child for the industry. These folks have done an amazing job, he said. They are truly an American success story in business, starting with just two people, and now they have over 120. The real unique part about Benke is they continue to grow. The article is accompanied by a picture of Chad Benke, and also a picture of the buildings that are mentioned in the article. The picture is taken from a distance and shows the building silhouetted against the blue sky. On the Dubuque and Tri-State page, we have a story by Ali Hinga. Relief bill to restore Medicaid eligibility to local Marshallese. A longtime healthcare barrier for Dubuque's Marshallese community is poised to come to an end. The massive pandemic relief package that Congress pushed toward passage on Monday included provision for which the Marshallese and other local leaders have long advocated, the restoration of their Medicaid eligibility. It's a big relief, said Reverend Stan Sampson, who pastors at Dubuque Paradise Church and is from the Marshall Islands. This has been a long-time struggle, and I have been one of the advocates for the Marshallese community in town and in Dubuque, Iowa, and this is one of the main points and main issues that we've been trying to resolve. Marshallese people residing in the U.S. have been unable to access Medicaid since 1996, when a federal welfare reform bill stripped eligibility for the health care program from people living in the U.S. under a compact of free association. In a statement Monday to the Telegraph Herald, U.S. Representative Abby Finkenauer, Democrat of Iowa, said the move to restore Medicaid eligibility to the Marshallese was, quote, long overdue, unquote. Permanently restoring the Marshallese community access to Medicaid is the right thing to do, and I'm happy I could help lead the fight to correct a wrong, the statement reads. Brendan Conley, a spokesman for U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican of Iowa, wrote in a statement that Ernst has heard from Iowans, particularly from around Dubuque, about the importance of the issue. She said, she is pleased this bipartisan deal could help resolve this matter and make a positive impact for Iowa families, Conley wrote. Gary Collins, CEO of Crescent Community Health Center in Dubuque, said the move is a game changer for local Marshallese community members who have lost jobs during the pandemic or have family with no insurance. Having Medicaid opens up more of an avenue for them to obtain those types of screenings as the other recipients of Medicaid currently get, Collins said. Irene Singra Mon said she was so excited when the news broke on Sunday that she could not sleep. It means a lot to us, and it's already spread out, said Mon, who grew up in the Federated States of Micronesia and now works at Crescent. Everyone's calling and calling and saying, hey, we did it. Oh, yes, we did it. She said some members of the Marshallese community who have low incomes have avoided receiving health care because they don't feel they can afford it. Allowing them to receive Medicaid should help them access that care, as well as help them handle the COVID-19 pandemic that already has taken a heavy toll on the Marshallese community, Mon said. She said she plans to follow up with local Marshallese community members to encourage them to take advantage of the opportunity to sign up for Medicaid. She said, "I will do my best to reach out and make sure they're using it." The article is accompanied by pictures of those mentioned in the article, Pastor Stan Sampson and Irene Singra Mon. And now we turn to the opinion page for Letter from the Editor, Words of Thanks, Local Heroes, and a Gift of Puzzles by Amy Gilligan, the Telegraph Herald Executive Editor. I've received many positive comments and notes of appreciation for the series that began Sunday, COVID-19's Toll, which told some of the many stories of the people in our community lost to the virus. The real thanks, though, goes to the individuals and families that were willing to speak to us, to give the community a glimpse into the life of their loved one lost to COVID. For so long, we have been tracking the death toll and reporting on the number of lives lost in our area, but that tells just a fraction of the story. Harder to illustrate is the hole left in the world when these folks died. Numbers on the chart say nothing of the grief that family and friends feel as they mourn the loss of loved ones. Bennett Goldstein set out to tell some of those stories with his reporting, to put real faces on those static numbers. We wanted to tell a bit about how these individuals lived, not just how they died. It made for some heartbreaking journalism, but anyone who has ever lost someone knows there is comfort in talking about the life of those we lost. To those who shared their stories, know that an empathetic community is thinking of all of you. Next, we'd like to look for some of the uplifting stories of the pandemic. No doubt all of us have had to lean on the support of others during this pandemic. We want to highlight some of the people across our tri-state area who haven't gotten the headlines during the COVID-19 pandemic, but who reached out to help others. Maybe it is a teacher, a store clerk, or a nursing home staff member who has gone the extra mile. Maybe it is a volunteer or a family member who helped in a unique way. We'd like to honor some of the people who have played a key role in making sure some things still are operating smoothly. Is there someone in the community you want to express appreciation for? Submit your everyday hero to the Telegraph Herald by Monday, December 28, and we will share them all online and many in an upcoming print edition. To submit someone, send us their name, hometown, and or place of employment, and why you nominated them. Feel free to include a photo and let us know how to get in touch with you if we have to follow-up questions. Help us highlight these important local residents. Send all everyday heroes via email to dustin.kass@thmedia.com. And finally, a gift of puzzles. In this trying year, I wish I could give every reader a gift to show my appreciation for your support of local journalism, but I don't think I could get 20,000 fruitcakes at this point. Instead, I got something I know our readers enjoy, more puzzles. This week we'll run some special extra puzzle pages. First, on Christmas Day, watch for a 2-page package that includes crosswords, Sudokus, a seek and find puzzle, a super quiz, and some games, riddles, and questions for kids. The next one will be an extra page in the Sunday, December 27 edition, and will also include a crossword, a Christmas-themed Sudoku, a picture for kids to color, and a couple of unique puzzles I think readers will enjoy. One of those, Wonder World by David Ouellet, is a bit of a sneak preview. We plan to add Wonder World to our lineup in mid-January. It's a seek-and-find puzzle with an added twist. I'll write more about that in January, but you can check out Wonder Word in this Sunday's Telegraph Herald. From our TH family to yours, we wish you health and happiness this holiday season. Thank you for reading, for being engaged in our storytelling, and for supporting local journalism. Also on the opinion page, we have a guest column, An Other View, by Star Parker of Creator Syndicate, titled Trump Made Major Strides Toward Making America Great Again. A retrospective on President Donald Trump's 4 years in office must be put in perspective of what he himself promised to accomplish when he ran, Make America Great Again. To answer the question requires, of course, defining what makes America great and asking to what extent President Trump put the nation on course toward this goal. If one believes, as I do, that what makes America great is that it must be a free nation under God, that this stands at the core of what makes the nation prosperous and moral, I think President Trump's achievements have been significant. Probably the greatest paradox of this election is the Gallup poll done in September asking whether registered voters were better off now than they were 4 years ago. The 56% who responded yes was the highest percent under any president running for re-election since Ronald Reagan ran for re-election in 1984. Based on this, we would have expected President Trump to be re-elected in a landslide. I would list major achievements of the Trump presidency under three headlines: economic reform that restored robust economic growth, appointment of federal judges across the nation, up to the Supreme Court, who will restore a federal judiciary guided by conservative principles, and achievement of a new peace in the Middle East that seemed beyond anyone's reach. Another point of critical importance is that Trump policies have been a boon to America's minorities. Despite the success of left-wing demagogues in portraying the Trump's presidency as racist, facts show truth to be the complete opposite. The 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act fueled economic growth that the nation had not seen in years. This was aided further by deregulation. Tax cuts and deregulation targeted at restoring the global competitiveness of American business and restoring conditions friendly to investment fueled job growth and an unemployment rate of 3.5% that no one thought possible. And as reported by the Wall Street Journal, median weekly full-time earnings for blacks increased 19% in Trump's first 3 years to $806. That followed a period of 11% growth during President Obama's 7 post-recession years in office. According to the Federal Reserve's 2019 Survey of Consumer Finances, the largest growth in household net income, net worth from 2016 to 2019 occurred in households in the lowest 20% of income, 34.3%. Black median household income increased 7.9% in 2019, the largest annual increase in history. And in 2019, for the first time ever, the percentage of black households earning above $75,000, 29.4%, exceeded the percentage earning below $25,000, 28.7%. With the confirmation of Trump's last Supreme Court appointee, Associate Justice Amy Coney Barrett, we now have a Supreme Court with a solid 6-3 conservative majority. This, in the overall context of 220 federal judicial appointments made by Trump, establishing a powerful conservative basis in law for our free nation under God. Despite what liberals say, this is enormously important for minority Americans. An example is the Supreme Court ruling earlier this year in the Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue case, which found unconstitutional the state prohibition of use of public funds for scholarships to attend private religious schools, known as the Blaine Amendment. This is a boon for school choice that poor and low-income Americans vitally need. And, of course, a conservative court raises the possibility of stopping the abortion carnage that is devastating Black America. President Trump's courage in moving the American embassy in Israel to Jerusalem and recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital shined light throughout the world. And now we are seeing new peace agreements between Israel and Arab and Muslim nations that no one ever thought possible. This is called leadership. Despite the noise and distortions from the left, facts say that Trump made major achievements in moving toward making America great again. That was the guest column by Star Parker, president of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education. And it says readers can reach Parker by emailing star-parker@urbancure.org. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Tuesday, December 22nd, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. And among the funeral services, very briefly listed and alphabetical, Ann E. Cherry Copeland, Benton, Wisconsin, visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today. Casey McNett, Funeral Home and Cremation Services, Cuba City, Wisconsin, Massive Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, December 23rd, St. Patrick's Church, Benton. Daniel H. Cobble, Dubuque, visitation 3 to 7 p.m. today. Engelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home, Dubuque. Massive Christian Burial, 10 a.m. Wednesday, December 23rd, St. Anthony's Catholic Church, Dubuque. Hugo L. Engelken, Dyersville, visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, December 28, Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Massive Christian Burial, 10 a.m. Tuesday, December 29, St. Francis Xavier Basilica, Dyersville. Mary C. Fisher, Dubuque, visitation 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. today, Holy Family Church, New Mallory, Iowa. Massive Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. today at the church. Kevin D. Gockel, East Dubuque, Illinois, visitation 9 to 11:15 a.m. today, St. Mary's Church, East Dubuque. Massive Christian Burial, 11:30 a.m. today at the church. Irvin E. Kleinsch, Bernard, Iowa, Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. today, St. Martin's Catholic Church, Cascade. Nancy M. Luffelholtz, Platteville, Wisconsin, visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 23rd, Melby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville. Eleanor M. Noble, Platteville, Wisconsin, services 11 a.m. today, Lima Union Cemetery, Platteville. Leo W. Reisner, Potosi, Wisconsin, visitation 4 to 6 p.m. St. Andrew Catholic Church, Tennyson, Wisconsin. Mass of Christian Burial, 1:30 p.m. Wednesday, December 23, Sacred Heart Catholic Church, Olwine, Iowa. Arlene J. Seymour, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, services 11 a.m. today, Ferryville Cemetery. And now among our regular notices, we have Gerald F. Pickle, age 89, of Dubuque, completed his earthly journey on December 19 at home, surrounded by his loving family. A private family memorial mass will be held. Burial will be held at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Larger celebration of life will be held in the summer when the entire family can gather together. Gerald's in lieu of flowers, memorials may be made in Gerald's name to Hospice of Dubuque, Holy Ghost Church, and Stonehill Care Center. Online condolences may be shared with Gerald's family at tristatecremationcenter.com, and that was for Gerald F. Pickle, who died December 19 at the age of 89. Savannah, Illinois, George von Essen, 83, of Menominee, Wisconsin, and formerly of Savannah, died Friday, December 18, in Menominee. A private service and Masonic service will be held with burial at Spring Lake Cemetery, and the Law Jones Funeral Home of Savannah is assisting the family of George von Essen, who died on December 18 at the age of 83. Richard M. Russell, 67, of Marquette, died Saturday, December 19, at Gunderson Health in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Services will be held at a later date. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Services of McGregor, assisting the family of Richard M. Russell of Marquette, who died December 19 at the age of 67. Elizabeth S. Humiston, 92, of Fenimore, died on Tuesday, December 15. There will be no formal service at this time. Burial will be at Fort Bayard National Cemetery, Fort Bayard, New Mexico. The Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster is assisting the family of Elizabeth S. Humiston, who died at the age of 92 on December 15th. Elizabeth is from Fenimore, Wisconsin. Jerome L. Koch, or Koch, K-O-C-H, Jerome L. Koch, 84, of Dyersville, died on Monday, December 21. Funeral arrangements pending. Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville, for Jerome L. Koch of Dyersville, who was 84 when he died on December 21st. Warren J. Peterson, 93, of Dubuque, died on Saturday, December 19. Family private services will be held at Linwood Cemetery. Engelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory of Dubuque is assisting the family of Warren J. Peterson, 93, of Dubuque, who died on December 19. Karen Dunn, 83, of Davenport and formerly of Bellevue, died on Saturday, December 19. Complete arrangements are pending at Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Bellevue for Karen Dunn, who died at the age of 83 and on December 19th. David R. Roth, 56, of Dubuque, died Saturday, December 19, at Fort Madison Community Hospital in Fort Madison. Visitation 9 a.m. till 12 p.m. Wednesday, December 23rd, at Hoffman, Snyder, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service on Asbury Road. The funeral service for David will be at 12 p.m. Wednesday, December 23, at Hoffman, Snyder, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service, with Scott Glover officiating. The service will be live streamed on the Hoffman, Snyder, and Kitchen Funeral Home's Facebook page, and also available at its website. In lieu of flowers, a memorial has been established in David's name. Hoffman, Snyder, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Services and care of arrangements, and you can offer tributes and condolences to the family by visiting David's obituary at the Hoffman, Snyder, and Kitchen Funeral Home website. And that was for David H. Roth of Dubuque, who died Saturday, December 19, at the age of 56. Daniel H. Cobble, Daniel Hartford, known as Dan Cobble, 74, of Dubuque, died Sunday, December 20. Visitation 3 to 7 p.m. today at Engelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on John F. Kennedy Road. Mass of Christian burial, 10 a.m. Wednesday, St. Anthony Catholic Church, where military rites will be accorded following Mass. Burial will be at in Mount Calvary Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Daniel Cobble Memorial Fund. And as mentioned, Engelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is handling arrangements for Daniel H. Cobble, Dan Cobble, 74, of Dubuque, who died Sunday, December 20, at the age of 74. New Vienna, Iowa, Lawrence A. Lansing, 85, died on Saturday, December 19, at his farm in New Vienna. Visitation, 3 to 7 p.m. today at Kramer Funeral Home on 12th Avenue Southwest in Dyersville. Visitation will continue Wednesday, 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at St. Boniface Catholic Church prior to funeral services. Mass of Christian burial, 1 p.m. Wednesday, December 23, St. Boniface Catholic Church, New Vienna, with burial in the church cemetery. Reverend Dennis Quint will officiate. Cards and letters, memorials may be mailed to the family in care of the Kramer Funeral Home of Dyersville. Please include first and last name, Lawrence Lansing, on the outside of the envelope. Condolences left at the for the family at kramerfuneral.com for Lawrence A. Lansing of New Vienna, who died at the age of 85 on December 19th. Elaine E. Lansing, Elaine Estelle Lansing, 76, of Dubuque, died Monday, December 21st. At her home in Dubuque. Private family mass of Christian burial for Elaine will be 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 23rd, St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church, with Father Jim Gorend as the celebrant. Their burial will be in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Key West in Dubuque. The mass will be live streamed on the Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Homes webpage or Facebook page, and will also be available to view later on its website. A public celebration of Elaine's life will be held on her birthday in July in 2021. As mentioned, the Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Services in charge of arrangements. Photo tribute can be viewed and condolences sent to the family by visiting Elaine's obituary at the cemetery website, and that was for Elaine Estelle Lansing, 76, who died Monday, December 21st. Dean J. Bennett, Deanne J. Bennett, Darlington, Wisconsin, was age 83, she died on December 20th, Sunday, at Lafayette Manor in Darlington, Wisconsin. A funeral service will be held Monday, December 28th. At 11 a.m. at Erickson Funeral Home on Main Street, Darlington, the Reverend Kate Kiekhafer of Grace Lutheran Church officiating. Burial will be in Union Grove Cemetery. Visitation Monday, December 28th from 9 a.m. until 10:45 a.m. at the funeral home. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at ericksonfuneralhome.com. Memorial Fund has been established in Deanne's name, and that was for Deanne J. Bennett, who died on December 20th at the age of 83. And now we turn to the sports page for some high school sports news. Prep wrestling, Hempstead 79, Cedar Rapids Jefferson, nothing. Physical domination, Hempstead flexes balance in shutout of Jayhawks. Reported by Tim O'Neill. Dubuque Hempstead has its own Big Four, but the Mustangs' dominance extends far beyond just those four wrestlers. On Monday night, against a shorthanded and overwhelmed Cedar Rapids Jefferson squad, Hempstead showed just how dominant it can be this season. Hempstead earned bonus points in 10 of the 11 contested matches, and 9 Mustangs won by fall in a 79-0 dismantling of Cedar Rapids Jefferson at Moody Gymnasium. "We're pretty balanced," said Hempstead coach Chuck Haas, who earned his 301st career dual victory. "We don't really have holes in our lineup. We just put 14 guys out there that scrap hard and are getting better every day so far." The balance showed on Monday. Not only did the Big Four out Chad Bayless at 126, Adler Kramer, 138, Aiden Dunn at 182, Caden Lovett, 285, win by fall, so did JoJo Lewis at 195, Gable Brooks at 120, Landon Reason at 126, Jackson Vanderhayden at 145, and Cole Rettenmeyer at 152. Hempstead rolled to 3-0 in duels after a delayed start to the season. "We have a lot of athletes, a lot of guys that like to work hard in the room," said Kramer, a state semifinalist last year. "They wrestle their hearts out. It was a tight battle for the quickest pin, too." Lewis entered an early favorite in just 33 seconds before Lovett lowered the bar to 31 seconds. Rettenmeyer secured the quickest fall in the last contested bout, pinning Connor Lundsman in just 25 seconds. "We're finding ways to put people on their backs, whether it's getting near falls or getting falls, and that's a good recipe for success," Haas said. Cole Thill nearly made it 10 pins for Hempstead, opening the duel with a 13-1 major decision at 170 pounds. Thill nearly had Jefferson's Ryan Chamberlain on his back and nearly had his shoulders on the mat as time expired. Dunn followed with a clinic at 182, surging to a 5-0 lead in the first 25 seconds, then adding two more tilts over the next minute before sticking Luke Moses in 157. Lewis, who is now 7-0 with 5 pins in his debut season, used an inside trip to take down the Jayhawks' Nick Graham, then turned it into a fall in just 33 seconds. "He's getting good. He's getting really good," Haas said. "He's getting scary good. How much better he's getting every day. I'm really proud of him. He's a good kid, and we really like what he's doing for us." Adam Ward won a 4-2 decision over Caleb Knight at 220 before Lovett booked his pin of Zane Wilson. Loman Duffy, 106, and Dawson Fish, 113, earned forfeit victories. Brooks pinned Max Lathrop in 53 seconds, and Reason followed with a fall over Sukuru Buderi in 331. Bellis, 2019 Illinois Class A state champion, pinned Austin Clifton in 156, and two-time Iowa State qualifier Kramer stuck A.J. Buzinski in 248. Vanderhayden made it 5 straight pins with his pin in 352 over Frank Buderi. Rettenmeyer provided an exclamation mark with his pin before Jack Smith closed the duel with a forfeit victory at 106. Hempstead will get a couple stiffer tests coming out of the holiday break, beginning with the annual county clash against Western Dubuque on January 2nd. The following weekend, the Mustangs welcome Southeast Polk, Waverly Shell Rock, and Ankeny to Moody Gym for what should be a showcase of strong wrestling. "I think we're going to surprise people. We just have to keep taking care of our business," Haas said. "We've got some duels right after the break that may end up making or breaking us, so we have to be ready to go out of the chute." The article is accompanied by a color picture of two heavyweight wrestlers, and the caption says, "Dubuque Hempstead's Caden Lovett, top, applies a hold on Cedar Rapids' Jefferson's Zane Wilson during their 285-pound wrestling match at Moody Gymnasium Monday night in Dubuque. The Mustangs cruised to a 79-0 victory." And the article is accompanied by a couple of those mentioned, Coach Chuck Haas and Adler Kramer. Then we have a few brief items under the heading More Than the Score, reported by Jim Leitner. Fast Pitch Hall of Fame honors trio of standouts. The Dubuque Fast Pitch Hall of Fame inducted Larry Portson, Greg Kuehl, and Randy Garrardi into its fraternity in 2020, and the three will be honored alongside next year's class in early June. Portson's fast pitch career spanned over 30 years. He played various positions, but was mainly known as a solid first baseman who had a consistent bat that could keep the ball in play. He played most of his years in the fast-pitched major league with Weber's Excavating, Ring's Restaurant, Tri-State Merchants, Windsor Tap, Murph's South End, and Butter's Bar. In addition to his stellar league play, Portson played in more than 25 Iowa State fast-pitch tournaments and two ASA national tournaments. Kuhl's fast-pitch career began in 1973 with the organization of his first team and securing his sponsor, the Dew Drop Inn. During his 15-year career, he also played for Idle Hour, Finale Lounge, Spielman's, Ring's Restaurant, and Tri-State Merchants. A third baseman for most of his career, Kuhl was known for his solid defense and constant bat in the heart of the lineup. He played competitively until injury forced him to retire. Later in his career, he managed the Ring's Restaurant teams from 1982 to 1985, won an Iowa State tournament, and advanced to the 1985 World Tournament in Kimberly, Wisconsin. Girardi's career spanned more than 11 years, with some of the dominant teams in the 1980s. He played for Weber Excavating, Q-Master, Tri-State Merchants, and Universal Financial. He contributed to a Weber Excavating team that dominated the Dubuque fast-pitch scene in the 1980s by winning the Kiwanis Tournament in 1982, 1984, and 1986, other numerous local tournaments, and qualifying for the 1988 ISC Tournament. Primarily a second baseman, Girardi was known as a gritty, hard-nosed player, a solid contact hitter who rarely struck out, a great defensive player, and an on-field team leader. A second item, Eagle Ridge named Best Golf Resort in Midwest. The North Star Meeting Group recently named Eagle Ridge Resort and Spa as the 2020 recipient of the Stella Award as the best golf resort in the Midwest. The Galena-based resort won the award for the second consecutive year. The Stella Awards are the meeting industry's highest honor, recognizing hotels, convention centers, and conference centers, airlines, cruise lines, DMOs, CVBs, and DMCs that consistently deliver quality service and innovation to meeting and event professionals. Eagle Ridge features the new Highlands Restaurant and Lounge, 289, and four golf courses, including the General, which ranks as one of the top 100 courses in the country. And a third item, WIAA Executive Director to retire in July. Dave Anderson, the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association, will retire on July 30, 2021. The 61-year-old joined the WIAA staff in 1998 and has served in his current role since August 1, 2009, following the retirement of Doug Chickering. He is just the fifth executive director since the position was created in 1924. Anderson is credited with eliminating membership dues and fees, providing concussion insurance to every member, school, student, athlete, and eliminating the football scenario of 3 games in 10 days, transitioning to 5 divisions in basketball, and the relocating of the girls' basketball tournament to Green Bay. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, on this Tuesday, December 22nd. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.